Good morning, Connecticut, and to all our friends across the Sound. We hope you had a blessed Thanksgiving weekend. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're going to open up this Thanksgiving weekend show celebrating agricultural preservation with the Working Lands Alliance, a project of the American Farmland Trust. We'll learn more about the organization and the individuals and initiatives recently honored for farmland protection at the annual Alliance meeting. Then we'll replay a September report focusing on health in the workplace, unveiling a recent study from researchers at the UConn Health Network, and we'll be discussing why Connecticut's number of workplace-related illnesses is so much higher than the national average. Then we'll close connecting with an expert in public health and oncology during the Great American Smokeout to discuss the ties between smoking and lung cancer, as well as the growing number of resources available to folks looking to kick the habit. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. In recognition of National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month and National Family Caregiver Month, the Goldstone Caregiver Center at Danbury Hospital will present a lecture on Knowledge is Power, Planning for the Future When Your Loved One Has Dementia. The program takes place Monday, November 30th from 10 to 11:30 at the Robilotti Conference Room at Danbury Hospital. For more information or to RSVP, call the Goldstone Caregiver Center at 203-739-7888 or visit WCHN.org. And don't forget, winter's on the way, but there's always something wild going on at Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo. Get in the holiday spirit and join Frosty and friends for breakfast at the zoo this holiday season. Event dates are being scheduled between December 5th and 20th from 9 to 11 a.m., but reservations are required. Cost is $10 per person for zoo members and $15 per person for non-members. Price includes zoo admission, photo ops with the characters, and breakfast. Call 203-394-6574, or to learn about the many other seasonal activities at Connecticut's only zoo, visit BeardsleyZoo.org. Regular listeners know how dedicated the award-winning For the People is to Connecticut's farmers and farmers in general, as well as the agricultural industry. So it was with great interest that we received a notification from our guest this morning, Lisa Bassini, project director at the Working Lands Alliance, that the organization just held its meeting and presented a number of awards, a legislative leadership award, as well as Pathfinder awards. At their annual meeting and luncheon. The Alliance is a division or subsidiary of the American Farmland Trust, the only national conservation organization dedicated to protecting farmland, promoting sound farming practices, and keeping farmers on their land. So, Lisa, thanks for joining us on the program this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So beyond that austere introduction, let's talk a little bit about yourself and your involvement with this organization and what brought your passions to the Working Lands Alliance.
Great. So I am the project director for the Working Lands Alliance. And as you said, we are a statewide coalition dedicated to farmland protection here in Connecticut. Our alliance includes really the principal conservation and agriculture organizations in the state. Includes Connecticut Farm Bureau, Connecticut Farmland Trust, UConn Extension, Connecticut NOFA, Connecticut Land Conservation Council, and a number of others. So really the principal groups and individuals working on conservation and agricultural issues. And we convene those, really focus a very tight agenda on farmland protection and how we can increase the amount of farmland we are protecting in the state so that we, reach the goal set by the legislature back in the 1970s.
It's been a pretty exciting quarter century for me, farming and agriculture being a kind of a broadcasting passion on my end, and seeing how organizations like yours and your partners and supporters are all working toward sustaining and growing agriculture. We've seen great news over the past 5 years with the identification, the real-time identification of what farming is actually worth here in Connecticut, and much more recently in the past few weeks, an announcement coming out of Senator Chris Murphy's office about some funds coming down to help new farmers in the state of Connecticut learn how to get into the business, to maybe pick up on properties that are becoming available as retiring farmers have to make a decision between selling to developers or others versus continuing to tradition of farming. From your perspective, what are a couple of the most exciting things that are going on right now in the world of agriculture here in Connecticut?
Well, I think here in Connecticut, you see a real burgeoning interest, from young farmers who want to get into it. I think you are, as you know, Chris Murphy had noted, you're seeing the USDA and NRCS really stepping in to support our young farmers here. Here in Connecticut, we have a group of advocates that's by farmers and for farmers called the New Connecticut Farmer Alliance, and they're working to, act as a, really coordinating force for some of these young farmers. So I think you see that interest growing. I think you have we do in Connecticut. We're lucky to have a legislature that, and a governor for that matter, that, really do support agriculture and want to see it thrive in the state. You see, see the growing number of farmers markets here. So that message is getting to the consumers. I think people want to see our land protected, especially our farmland, understanding that that's really, that's critical to our quality of life here, to what we're eating, particularly, as we see climate change, affecting the world, and we want to see, our food grown here. So for me, those are, really the key points, the key things that we see and good trends, positive trends that we want to see continue.
Certainly programs like 4-H and a couple of the Connecticut technical colleges that are focusing on the subject and turning out graduates that are interested in agriculture, as well as the latest generation of family farmers in Connecticut are keeping the tradition going. But I mean, from my perspective on the sidelines, what seems to be really interesting is new folks that are coming into farming, folks who have kind of pushed away from the table of their legal practices and their restaurants and their other pursuits, folks who never really necessarily had their hands in the ground before, who now have the resources and support to kind of hit the ground running and make a great success out of a boutique initiative or perhaps even a larger scale agricultural operation.
Well, that's true, and I think if you look at the data, you actually see in Connecticut, and I believe this trend, goes throughout New England, is that actually a large percentage of what you would consider a new and beginning farmer, so 10 years or less on a farm operation, are people over the age of 45. So I think, that might surprise people. They just assume new and beginning farmers means a young farmer, but actually the data really shows that a significant portion of those, according to the agricultural census, that the federal government releases are people over the age of 45.
And I guess thanks to the farm-to-table type initiatives and the proliferation of coordinated promotion for farmers markets and CSAs, these individuals have a much greater potential for success, even if they have no farming or agriculture or even gardening in their background.
Right, and what you see with a lot of these farmers, particularly older farmers, is they might bring a different skill set to it. They might have a real business and a marketing background, and maybe they're coming on into it, and the farming part is where their really steep learning curve is, but they're bringing other skills and other expertise that they've drawn on from previous occupations that they may have had.
And at the same time, I guess we see family farmers three, four, five, six generations on gaining new skill sets that they never had before in terms of promotions and event management. Hosting weddings or farm tours and hay rides and things like that were never really part of their business model before.
Right, and that's correct. And I think you're seeing, you know, just a lot of diversification in that way of just trying to, find, you know, avenues for other sources of revenue on farm. And you see, you know, like I said, the proliferation of some of these agritourism activities on a number of our farms, certainly.
Excellent. Well, the Working Lands Alliance, as we said, announced its selections for the 2015 Farmland Preservation Pathfinder Awards at their annual meeting just a couple of weeks ago in mid-November. So we want to help celebrate these awardees. Let's talk a little bit about Ben Freund, who was the Pathfinder Award for Outstanding Individual. Tell us about Ben.
Right. So Ben owns and operates Freund's Farm up in North Canaan with his brother Matt and their families. And Ben is just one of those extraordinary individuals, not only just a terrific farmer and somebody who obviously, you know, very much supports farmland protection and all those things, but is, you know, really outspoken, somebody who gets out to the Capitol, out into his community to, you know, to really make these issues known. He does a lot of off-farm activities. This includes his service on the Farmland Preservation Advisory Board, which advises the Commissioner of Agriculture on its Farmland Preservation Program. He's the director for CoBank and formerly for Farm Credit East, and he's also a very active member of the Connecticut Farm Bureau. So I think you see Ben each and every year advocating for critical programs that support our farmers, taking that message directly to legislators, coming and advocating for these programs each and every year. And, these are critical messages that have to get delivered, and there's really nobody better to do it than a well-respected farmer like Ben. So we were really delighted to award him this year. He's really well-deserving. And again, there's, you know, there's really nobody better than Ben in terms of just how well respected he is among not only the farm community, but legislators as well.
Yeah. And I think, when people go to their local store and grab that bottle of milk off the shelf, they take for granted that it came from somewhere else. But in fact, Ben has been a great proponent and one of the latest generation members of his family to continue to support dairy agriculture here in Connecticut.
Absolutely. And, their family is, part of the Agrimark dairy cooperative and, producing for, cabbage cheeses. And I think you see the Freunds really, making that case for people of why local production is so important and why we want to be spending our consumer dollars on the kind of products that support family farms like Freund's Farm.
So your next award went to something called the Outstanding Group, which is the Last Green Valley, TLGV, have been working for two decades now promoting sound land use planning and sustainability. So it sounds like they got the sustainability bug a long time before the word sustainability was kind of being slapped around so frequently among folks talking about that issue.
Right, and you see their work, throughout the Northeast corner. I mean, they have their very, well-publicized Walktober activities, but they've also consistently in and out of those communities, supporting agriculture at all levels, promoting the kind of farm-to-table events, and just really, I think, making the case in each of these communities why farming is a preferred land use and why, the kind of work that this kind of work is so critical to how our communities live and operate and really promoting the agricultural economies in is considered the quiet corner in the northeast part of the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, and I guess also hand in hand with another issue that we don't always necessarily relate to agriculture, and that is forest production.
Right, exactly. So certainly agriculture is, encompasses many, many activities, you know, not only just the kind of, you know, crop production that I think most people assume, but absolutely that, you know, the forestry practices are, you know, are just as much as part of agriculture, and you've seen them, you know, be huge supporters, excuse me, of, you know, a whole range of agricultural economic activity.
Excellent. And I was so happy to see the smiling face of Joan Nichols in your release. She's been a guest on our program before, and I've had an opportunity to talk with her and see her in action in person at a couple of events over the past few years. She is the Connecticut Farm Bureau's Director of Member Relations and Community Outreach, and she was the Education Leader Award winner. Tell us a little bit about your experiences with working with Joan.
Well, Joan is a close colleague. I actually share an office space out of the Connecticut Farm Bureau office, so I see Joan in action day in and day out, and she's just absolutely a wonderful colleague, selfless, and just someone who spends, you know, each and every minute, really, of her day thinking about agriculture, thinking about, you know, educating our, you know, whether it's farmers, government officials, town staff, commission members, many others about, you know, a variety of agricultural issues. You know, this, you know, first and foremost, Joan is, you know, really a renowned expert on Public Act 490, which is, you know, taxing, agricultural lands at their agricultural use rather than their highest and best use, and really has been instrumental to keeping farmland in farming here in Connecticut. Joan, you know, does just an extraordinary amount of outreach on that. But there's, you know, a number of other, you know, educational tools she's put together. She put together the toolkit for Connecticut farmers, and that's, you know, to help producers and agricultural commissions, you know, really advocate for agriculture in their communities. So throughout, you know, just day to day, Joan is, you know, extraordinary. They joke that they need the clone Joan program here in Connecticut.
Yeah,
we need about, you know, 10 or 15 more Joans doing this kind of work, you know, with our farmers and with our town staff.
Yeah.
So again, it was just a delight to recognize Joan's hard work and tireless efforts over these years.
Yeah, and you mentioned the toolkit. I mean, in the spirit of, you know, teaching a person to fish versus giving them the fish, the toolkit for Connecticut farmers is way more than just a handbook on how to be a farmer. It really is an advocacy piece that helps promote ongoing education to many people in Connecticut.
Right, and this is, again, you know, just the kind of work of, you know, giving farmers the tools to advocate in their local communities on, you know, land use issues that affect their businesses. So that's the kind of the kind of tools and the resources she has put in the hands of Connecticut farmers so that their voice can be most effective at the local level.
Excellent. Folks, if you want to learn more about the great work of the Working Lands Alliance, you can visit their website, workinglandsalliance.org. Lisa, in the last minute or two that we have with you, are there any outreach events or activities or other things that you want to invite people to get to know your organization better?
Well, we just had our annual meeting, so that would have been the first thing. But really now that, you know, our events for the fall are over, we had a fundraising event and a workshop on succession planning for farmers, and then our annual meeting. But right now we're really turning our attention to preparing for the legislative session that's upcoming. We certainly know that that it's going to be a difficult budget session. You know, we see the reports coming out of, you know, legislators really grappling with those deficits. So, you know, really now for the next couple months, we turn our attention to really honing in on our advocacy agenda for the 2016 legislative session, and just be sure that the things that we feel so strongly about, you know, continue to be prioritized here in Connecticut, and that we're making the investments in farmland preservation, even in a bad budget season. And that's, you know, really critical to us, that we continue to make progress on protecting our critical farmland here in Connecticut, and just ensure that the state is investing in those programs the way they should. So that's really what we turn our attention to now. But, you know, for folks that want to, you know, get on our email list, we communicate over the course of the session with our members about opportunities to advocate and join us in our advocacy efforts for, you know, on behalf of Connecticut farmland.
And all you need to do to keep tabs on that or to sign up for their email correspondence is go to workinglandsalliance.org. Out of Bloomfield, our guest this morning, Lisa Bassini, Project Director for Working Lands Alliance. Thank you for being part of the program, Lisa. So just before Labor Day, we learned that there was some disturbing information coming out of UConn Health about Connecticut, and particularly in terms of workplace illnesses. Connecticut workers continue to suffer occupational illnesses at a rate higher than the national average, with a 6% increase in the rate of total reported cases. And right now, while we like to think of Connecticut as being a national leader in everything from basketball to technology and many other things, as far as occupational health, we're down in the middle of the pack, almost smack dab in the middle, actually, at ranked at about 25 among 50 states for the state's workplace health index. So we were pleased that Dr. Tim Morse, professor emeritus at UConn Health, was able to join us on the phone this morning to talk a little about it. Tim, welcome to the program.
John, thanks for having me.
So let's start talking a little bit about how this all came to be, Tim. Is this a report that you sort of kind of look at on an interior basis every year, and suddenly because things started to sort of tip in the wrong direction, you and UConn Health decided to kind of make a better public awareness push out of it?
Well, we've been doing an annual report for, probably 20 years now, and the impetus for it was just an increased recognition of occupational illness more generally in the country and in Connecticut in particular, and that occupational illnesses as opposed to injuries are harder to track. So we're talking about illnesses such as carpal tunnel syndrome and musculoskeletal disorders and infectious disease and lung disease, skin disorders, as opposed to traumatic injury things. So we don't cover in this report things like people falling off scaffolds or cutting their hands in saws, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. And occupational illnesses are harder to track. So we put together a system in Connecticut that links together the Connecticut Department of Labor, Con OSHA in particular, and the Workers' Compensation Commission, the Department of Public Health, and UConn to put together numbers and estimates on occupational illness so we can track them over time.
Does the Department of Health regard individuals impacted by occupational illness in sort of a different statistical light than individuals who are injured in terms of either affecting programs for prevention or awareness?
They do approach them differently. They're certainly concerned about both, but illnesses tend to fall more under public health, and since the ways of both tracking these kinds of illnesses are different than injuries. For example, the Department of Public Health relies a lot on physician reporting for occupational illnesses, for example, as opposed to just workers' comp and OSHA for injuries, which are kind of more clearly reported. So they're looking to try to track them differently, and the preventive strategies are different as well. They tend to be longer term as opposed to shorter term, so things like ergonomics for musculoskeletal disorders, things like substituting safer chemicals for toxic chemicals in regards to skin and lung disease, using safe needle devices for bloodborne illnesses like HIV or hepatitis. So those are the kinds of things that the state health department and local health departments, to some extent as well, look at more as part of their kind of health tracking and prevention efforts.
Yeah, and this all kind of folds through Connecticut's office into a larger database that OSHA provides that helps to track issues like this on a national basis.
That's right. So Con OSHA at the Connecticut Labor Department participates in the national survey that that OSHA and the Bureau of Labor Statistics coordinates. And so those are the numbers that we use for national comparisons. There are other. We also track the physician's reports, as I mentioned, but also workers' comp. And then we try to combine those databases as much as we can to get a clearer picture. So, for example, the Labor Department statistics let us look at comparisons with the OSHA numbers. So we've been consistently tracking higher than the national average for occupational illnesses. This year we're at about 8% higher than the U.S. rate. And they're tracking a little bit higher in terms of unique cases. So one of the things that I do when I put together this report is I match the workers' comp cases with the physician's report cases so that we can identify the total number of unique cases that are reported to one system or the other. Mm. There's less overlap than you'd expect. It's actually kind of unusual. You'd think you'd have pretty good reporting in Connecticut, but there's actually very little overlap. So while the workers' comp, we have about 6,000 cases that get reported. Physicians report about 2,500, but unique cases are about almost 8,000, so that there's not much overlap between the two data systems.
Okay. Well, the few other interesting points that are coming out of the data that's sitting here in front of me is, first of all, folks should know in the latest reporting year, which was 2013, there were a little over 7,600 unique cases. You just said almost 8,000 here in Connecticut. But the breakdown of where those cases are happening is bizarre to me when you're looking at the numbers. That 37 municipalities had more than 50 cases of occupational illnesses each, but where those occupational illnesses landed is intriguing. Farmington with 163 cases per 10,000 workers, when the state average is just about 37. Then Groton with 118, Norwich with 110, Westbrook with 95, and then Pomfret with 77, all of these tracking way above the state average. Do you have a handle on what target points of employment or what types of jobs are concentrated in this diverse range of communities across Connecticut that led to these spikes of numbers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So the numbers are based on where people are employed. So it's based on the companies in those towns that are reporting occupational illness cases. And we try to protect the individual names of employers in doing this report. So it's best to look at kind of the industry composition that comes from those. So Farmington, for example, has a lot of government workers, has health care workers, and it has manufacturing. So all those are, oddly enough, concentrated in Farmington, and those are all high illness rate industries. So some of those are a little counterintuitive. I mean, you think of manufacturing as being something that there'd be a lot of occupational illness, you know, in kind of the normal way of thinking. But you don't think of government workers or healthcare as being something that's hazardous work in the normal way that we think of it.
You know, a lot of repetitive motion, I guess.
That's right.
And things like that. Proximity to other folks who are ill that could cause the contraction of illness, I guess.
Right. So healthcare, you get a lot of infectious disease. That's right. And when you look at government workers, it's actually, you know, includes police and fire. So you have a lot of stress cases, heart and hypertension cases. You have outdoor workers who are exposed to poison ivy and Lyme disease, and those tend to be fairly high numbers that come in as far as skin disease and infectious disease. So that's right. So it's for illnesses in particular, they tend to be high industries.
Yeah. And what's going on in Pomfret?
That one I don't know. I haven't tracked down the actual employers there. Again, you'd be looking at kind of the usually, you know, particularly when you're talking about, you know, the numbers with more than 50 cases, towns with more than 50 cases, you'd be looking at large employers. Mm. The other thing is physicians' reports tend to come mainly from occupational health clinics.
Oh, I get it.
And so, okay. And so if you have occupational health clinics that are located in towns, then you tend to get better physician reporting.
Sure, or a particularly busy or large capacity facility.
Correct.
You know, could cause the town to reflect that reporting number when, in fact, the industries that produce those injuries may be far-flung.
Well, no, it's based on the industries that are in that town.
Oh, I get it. I'm sorry.
But if those include hospitals or occupational health clinics, then you tend to get physician reports from that area.
Okay.
So
we're gonna. I'll tell you what. We're gonna take a quick break and come back and talk to you. We've got about 6 or 7 more minutes, and we've got a great conversation going on with Dr. Tim Morse. He's professor emeritus at UConn Health, and we're talking about the latest report on work-related illnesses. Connecticut is tracking 8% higher than the nation, and we're 25th in line for the safest states in the country in terms of occupational health. We're going to come back and finish our conversation with Dr. Tim Morse. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Join Easter Seals Goodwill at Lighthouse Point Park in New Haven for the 21st annual Fantasy of Lights, a spectacular and dazzling holiday tradition. The park is open nightly from 5 to 9 Sunday through Thursday and 5 to 10 on Fridays and Saturdays. Admission to Fantasy of Lights is $10 for passenger cars or family vans, $25 for 15 passenger minibuses, and $50 for full-size buses. All proceeds help support Easter Seals Goodwill Industries' mission to enhance employment, educational, social, and recreational opportunities for people with disabilities and other challenges. For details, call Easter Seals Goodwill at 203-777-2000 or visit esginh.org. Well, thanks for coming back. We're with Dr. Tim Morse. He is professor emeritus at UConn Health. He's overseen the distribution and data gathering for the latest 2013 work-related illness study that was produced out of Farmington, Connecticut. Dr. Morse, we talked about the putting this whole thing together and some of the statistical information and how to differentiate occupational disease versus occupational injuries. So now let's talk about how you put this information together to help affect some prevention and change in these statistics. Real Connecticut back up to the safest category and certainly reduce this disproportional incident of occupational illness.
That's right. So one basic thing to remember about occupational illness is that it's by definition preventable. So that's clearly the impact that we want to have in putting out this information and kind of helping to track what industries and towns and types of illnesses and types of exposures are resulting in these so that we can help with the preventive efforts.
Mm-hmm. And so a part of that prevention, is there one of the illnesses that you looked at that has a predominant presence in the workplace illness arena? Is it a lot mm-hmm. more of the repetitive motion?
Yeah. So the musculoskeletal, is either called repetitive motion or cumulative trauma, is the largest in all three of these reporting systems, accounting for roughly half of the reports that come in. So those are things like carpal tunnel syndrome, tendonitis, the sources that we see for those range from computer usage is one of the top, but there's a lot of reports from tool use and vibrating tools in particular, but pneumatic tools and other tools. Assembly work tends to be in there. And even though we don't focus on lower back injuries, which is a huge category, but it's hard to determine whether it's chronic or it's an acute injury. But where things are labeled as chronic, then those get brought in. And a lot of that where you see lower back tends to be in healthcare and patient handling, which tends to be one of the most dangerous jobs in the country, actually, for injuries and illnesses.
And I guess as the population and the workforce is aging and the deterioration of, the construction of the lower back begins to happen through natural order, and we're not filling those jobs with a lot of robust young people, statistic may not sadly be fading in the future, but perhaps growing. So musculoskeletal disorders account for a little more than half of all the reports, but it's also interesting to see that among the other conditions that you're listing are a couple that we talk about on this program a lot, and that is Lyme disease and asthma.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So infectious disease, Lyme disease is up there. Lyme disease is a little bit harder to track in terms of these reports because the descriptions aren't always as clear as you'd like. And so sometimes it's just describing tick bites and rashes that come from tick bites. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's describing out-and-out Lyme disease. But we see a lot of that, particularly among outdoor workers that are more likely to encounter ticks. And so we do see a fair amount of reports of tick bites and Lyme disease coming into the system.
And occupational asthma is also starting to get tagged as a workplace-generated ailment?
Yeah, so we do see a lot of workplace asthma. It's one of the highest of the lung conditions. The most frequent lung condition you see are respiratory disorders, which are kind of acute exposures to chemicals. But then following that, asthma is one of the leading ones. And occupational asthma you see among office workers where they're exposed to indoor air quality problems, and you also see it in relation to exposure to a number of chemicals, things like janitors using cleaning chemicals. Mm. So cleaning chemicals are fairly high on the list of causes of asthma.
Well, I have to say, Dr. Morris, this has been an incredibly enlightening and interesting conversation. It's something we're going to definitely be able to both help promote and talk more about as these reports continue to get generated every year. We'll be interested in following these statistics, and we thank you for exposing our listeners, wherever they may be, to the fact that Connecticut is keeping a very close eye on occupational illnesses with 7,669 unique cases reported in 2013. Connecticut is 8% above the national average in terms of occupational illnesses, landing smack dab in the middle of the pack at 25th rank among the 50 states as being the best or least for workplace illnesses. So we thank you for helping expand on some of the data in this report. Folks can certainly find out more about it if they go to, I guess there's a pretty long website, but they can call the UConn Health Center at 860-679-2368 to find out where they can get a free copy of Occupational Disease in Connecticut 2015, the report that was in great part compiled through the work of our guest this morning, Dr. Tim Morris, Professor Emeritus at UConn Health. It was great to meet you, Dr. Morris, and we can't wait to talk to you again. So folks who are listening may recognize the voice on the other end of the phone this morning, and that comes with a little bit of a humble correction here. Probably the first that I've ever done in the 27 years on the award-winning For the People. We got something wrong. That's right. A few weeks ago, you heard Dr. David Grew from St. Francis talking about prostate cancer, and that's because we mistakenly led him through an interview thinking that November was Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, when in fact that was in September, and we were supposed to be talking to Dr. Grew about the Great American Smokeout. So we have reconnected with Dr. Grew. I sort of pulled a Ron Burgundy, if you will, and kind of read the talking points that were in front of me instead of paying attention to the fact that we wanted to talk and prepare people for the Great American Smokeout. So we're doing the next best thing. We're reaching Dr. Grew on the day of the Great American Smokeout, and now delivering that interview a couple of weeks later to remind people about the dangers of tobacco use and lung cancer issues. If you recall, Dr. Grew had joined St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center as a radiation oncologist with Connecticut Radiation Oncology PC. He received his medical degree from Tulane and completed his residency at New York University School of Medicine in Radiation Oncology. He's also got a Master of Science in public health, so he's always willing and able to come on and talk about public health issues related to his field. You may have seen him on TV news during the morning of the Great American Smokeout, and he also blogs and has a great deal of information that would be available to you if you would be so kind to hook up with him on Twitter at David Grew, G-R-E-W. Dr. Grew, thanks for coming back. You're so kind to indulge the error of our ways here on the award-winning For the People, but there's never a bad time to talk about lung cancer and prevention. This year alone, 221,000 cases of lung cancer in the United States, a proportionate amount in Connecticut, well too many among your patients, I'm sure. Thanks for sticking with us on the program.
Thanks for having me back, John.
So as we're speaking to you on the day of the Great American Smokeout, your organization is doing free lung cancer screenings. Let's talk about some of the things tied to that terrible statistic of 221,000 cases of lung cancer in the U.S. Where are we at today, as we speak, in terms of a cure, if you will, for lung cancer?
Well, like we talked about last week with prostate cancer, the cure rates really depend on the stage at presentation. So for patients who actually are diagnosed with early stage lung cancer, the cure rates are pretty good. Some estimates as low as in the 60% range, but others in fit patients who are otherwise medically in good shape, cure rates can be up into the 80s and 90%. So that's kind of the best case scenario. So we actually can do pretty well for patients with early stage disease. Where we really need to do better is in patients who present and are diagnosed with more advanced stages of disease where treatments unfortunately are not as effective. And in that case, the cure rate is much lower.
Yeah, it really appears from the statistics in front of me that there is a disproportionate amount of lung cancer deaths considering the amount of diagnoses that are happening across the country. And I guess lung cancer is still one of the leading causes of cancer death. Is that just because folks don't come forward to try to get that diagnosis or the kinds of screenings that you're even doing today during the Great American Smokeout?
That's certainly part of it, but probably the biggest reason is that lung cancer just happens to inherently be a very aggressive type of disease. So you're right. You referenced the fact that we have about 220,000 cases of lung cancer in this country a year and about 160,000 deaths. That's a large proportion of the number of patients who even have the disease who actually die of the disease. Very different story when you talk about prostate and breast cancer. So that's a big part of it, that it's a very aggressive disease and it's very difficult to treat. So that's why we're doing these screening events to try and get patients in early to try and diagnose the disease before it becomes a life-threatening problem.
Yeah. The other thing that we're looking at is the phenomena between men and women, where apparently since around 1990, the amount of men being diagnosed with and dying from lung cancer is greatly decreased, while it was just about 10 years ago when the incidence of women being diagnosed with and dying from lung cancer hit its peak. How are those statistics doing now, 10 years later from this peak for women? Are you still engaging a lot of patients or hearing a lot from at the national level that this is still a much more significant issue for women than men?
Well, yeah, exactly. As you said, kind of the worst is behind us. The peak of lung cancer rates, it was in the 90s for men and just about 10 years ago for women. So the rates of new cases is on the decline. But, you know, I think everyone would agree when you're seeing 160,000 deaths a year in this country from this disease, even though the cases are on the decline, we still have an enormous public health challenge in front of us.
Well, given those statistics, are we at a point now in America where the kinds of screenings that you're doing as we speak to you today during the Great American Smokeout, does the need for these screenings need to be stepped up or maybe made a much more anticipated and regular part of the annual, checkup for people?
It does. Absolutely, it does. So we're trying to figure out what is the best way to increase awareness for this. And I think the more we do events like this, the lung screening that we're doing today, and also talking to people like you who are doing the good work of spreading the word, the more patients will be aware of this. And what we really need is to get the primary care docs involved in setting up the screening. And so part of that is educating our peers, but a bigger part of it perhaps is educating the people who then go in for their annual exam, as you said, and ask their doctors about whether or not there be a candidate for screening for lung cancer. Because it really needs to happen at the primary care level out in the community. Once patients come into the hospital with the cancer, we've missed our chance. It needs to happen out in the community when patients are otherwise healthy and just doing routine medical surveillance.
Mm. And there are kind of two different scenarios when you hear a loved one, a friend, a colleague, a neighbor has been diagnosed with lung cancer. You either hear something like, yeah, well, we're pack-a-day smoker for 20, 30 years, or, yeah, they worked around asbestos, or usually much more disturbing, that they never smoked a day in their lives and didn't really hang around or live with anybody that smoked, so they didn't get exposed to secondhand smoke either. So I guess the incidence among people who don't have that exposure or proximity are quite, that can be a very, very disturbing and frustrating situation.
Yeah, exactly. Those are some of the hardest cases we have, patients who come in without ever having had any kind of identifiable exposure that put them at risk. And it can happen. It absolutely can happen. While cigarette smoking is, of course, the biggest link to lung cancer, there's plenty of patients who we see who have never smoked in the past.
Mm. So to continue on with our partnering and initiative to educate people, let's move on to kind of breaking down the types of lung cancer that people may be diagnosed with. I understand there's three different kinds.
There are. So the most common, kind of your run-of-the-mill lung cancer, is called non-small cell lung cancer, and that comprises approximately about 80% of the cases that we see. The second most common type of lung cancer is called small cell lung cancer. Historically, this was sometimes called oat cell, although that term's not used as much medically anymore. And that's about 10 to 15% of lung cancer. And a rare tumor that we don't see very often but is still out there is called lung carcinoid tumor.
Mm.
Those are the three major types of lung cancer. lung cancers.
And it's the small cell lung cancer that's the traditionally the most aggressive?
That's correct. And also the one of those three types that we discussed that has the strongest link to smoking. However, non-small cell lung cancer is also certainly linked to smoking as well.
Can all three of these cancers be detected in the type of screening that you're doing at St. Francis today during the Great American Smokeout?
That's a great question. A lot of people are really interested in that because, as you mentioned, small cell, which makes up 10 to 15% of cases, can be more aggressive. So we'd love to have a screening mechanism try and find those cases early to get those people help. But the large clinical trials that showed a benefit to screening really focused on non-small cell lung cancer. And that's where the real benefit in terms of survival came. When they looked at patients with non-small cell lung cancer, again, the most common form, about 80% of the cases, patients who got screening with a CAT scan, like we did at St. Francis, had about a 20% less risk of dying from lung cancer. So this has now become a fairly routine recommendation for patients who are appropriate to have screening.
Great. We talked about this last week with prostate cancer, but now from a research and development perspective, what type of breakthroughs are you seeing, you and your peers seeing, not just across the country, but perhaps around the world, in terms of advances toward effective treatment?
Yeah, great question. So in radiation, probably the biggest advancement that we've had is in early stage, so very curable, treatable forms of lung cancer. Many patients, the standard of care treatment would be to get a surgical treatment, and the cancer is actually removed by a surgeon. Problem in lung cancer is, as you might imagine, a lot of these patients have a lot of other medical problems. They may have COPD, emphysema, bronchitis, other problems that make them perhaps not the best candidates to have an aggressive surgery. Mm-hmm. So for patients who can't have aggressive surgery but do have early stage lung cancer, they can now get a form of radiation called stereotactic radiation. And this basically allows the radiation oncologist to deliver a very high dose of radiation to the tumor while sparing most of the rest of the normal healthy lung and the other vital organs that are inside the chest. And what we found is when we use this treatment, we're actually able to achieve cure rates that are very comparable to the numbers that our surgeons are able to get. So this has been a huge advancement and represents an area where patients who historically, you know, going back a decade or more, did not have a really effective treatment option available to them. If they couldn't get surgery, then there wasn't really anything that was terribly effective. There were some treatments, but they were not as good as surgery. So stereotactic radiation represents an area where we've actually made major headway over the last 10 years.
Well, that's good to hear. Well, in the last few minutes that we have, let's turn to prevention. Obviously, just saying if you don't smoke, don't start. And if you smoke, take steps to cut down and quit is easy to say. But once again, thanks to advances, we're seeing things like Chantix. We're seeing the proliferation of programs providing nicotine gums and patches. Certainly, it seems science is an oncologist's best friend when it comes to creating initiatives and therapies to help individuals who are hopelessly hooked on nicotine to reduce or even eliminate nicotine in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So the days of just kind of white-knuckling it and going cold turkey are over. You know, we have a lot more at our disposal now, not only the pharmaceuticals you referenced, Chantix, but also, you know, the lozenges, the gum, the patches with nicotine supplements. We also have really effective smoking cessation programs, and they're actually experts in this field now who their main job is to develop a plan for a patient and to get them on board with sticking to the plan. And when we do this, we find that patients have a much higher success rate of quitting. So I would say to anyone who is a smoker and is interested in quitting to talk to your doctor about it and ask about setting up a plan. And nowadays, patients are having a much better time than they used to.
And from a public health guy, you got to be glad to see all of the kind of community health organizations and even, you know, support organizations that whose primary goal may not necessarily or specifically be medically related are coming out and underwriting or supporting or hosting certain types of established quit programs for tobacco use and smoking. So there's certainly a proliferation both on the scientific end and of the availability. And we're starting to see so many more programs, including the one with the state of New York a couple of years ago, at no cost to the individual that wants to quit. So it looks like America is getting it when it comes to smoking and smoking cessation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's really great to see that, and I think it's catching on, and you can see it in the numbers. I mean, the number of cases is on the decline, and that's a reflection of the fact that the public is really behind this now.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate your time this morning. Dr. David Grew is with St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center. He's a radiation oncologist with Connecticut Radiation Oncology. He's also got his Master's of Science in Public Health, and he joins us during the Great American Smokeout here in late November and reminding people about the importance of awareness when it comes to one of the largest killers of Americans and folks around the world, that is lung cancer. He is available to you with great advice and check-ins on Twitter at David Grew, G-R-E-W, if you want to check him out. Dr. Grew, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us again this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.